So, hello, and welcome to More Podcast, Less Process. This is your co-host, Josh, and I'm here with Jefferson.
Hello, Josh.
Hi, Jefferson. How are you doing?
Good. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah.
It's springtime in New York.
Yeah, it's a little dreary out, but it's not 20 degrees, so that's something.
Hey, that's the attitude. So, we're here. This is actually episode number 10.
Yes, double digits.
Yes, we've made it to double digits. So we're like 1/10 of the way to syndication. We're going to get some of that sweet syndication money. So, we are here with two guests, right?
Yes.
Okay.
We have two guests today.
Two guests, both from performing arts institutions in New York City. One from the east side, one from the west side.
Wow. So we'll, rivalry.
Yes. Yeah. So
they'll be throwing gang signs. I'll
try to not let that get in the way.
So I guess if you'd like to introduce yourselves for our listeners.
Hi, I'm Miwa Yokoyama, and I'm from the Carnegie Hall Archives.
And I'm Mitch Brodsky from the New York Philharmonic Archives.
Excellent. So we're talking to performing arts archivists who are also digitization managers.
Yeah, I guess our hypothetical theme of this podcast is managing large-scale digitization projects in archives, right. Sort of.
Right, and it's a great theme.
Yeah, I think everybody does it. Everybody
and you're the
digitizes.
Perfect guest for it.
Well, I do think that there's a growing trend for repositories to start to digitize large amounts of material in their collections, as opposed to what we were seeing even 5 years ago, 5-6 years ago, where and even back into the late 90s when people were digitizing small portions of their collections or highlights of their collections. And I think it's a great trend that says a lot about access and the fact that archivists are increasingly making their collections available to wide audiences for all kinds of purposes. And I hope we can talk a little bit about that access principle and how that affects research worldwide into our collections.
Yeah.
Excellent. So I guess maybe we should start, if each of you could maybe give a little bit of background on your particular institution and kind of what the archives is there and kind of the genesis of the projects that you're working on.
Who should start? You want to start?
Sure. Sure. So I guess the Carnegie Hall Archives has been collecting programs and photographs and flyers and other documentation of events and performances at Carnegie Hall since 1986. And we also have a museum, so our collection materials are featured in exhibits at the hall. Archives has traditionally played a reference role where we do research and answer requests for information from our staff and the public. The Archives is also responsible for the hall's records management. This new project is a 3-year digital archives project, and it's an initiative, grant-funded initiative, funded by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, the Mellon Foundation, the Grammy Foundation, and also the Susan and Elihu Rose Foundation.
All right.
And
everybody's involved.
Yeah.
Money from every direction.
Yes, we like that. And we are digitizing a majority of our archives. Our project kind of has three main objectives, where the first is that we want to ensure that our physical collections are stable and preserved. So we're doing conservation on a lot of our paper materials before digitization. The second part of our project is we want to increase access through digital surrogates. So we are digitizing not only our paper collections, but also a majority of our audiovisual holdings. So that includes archival study collections that are, audio tapes, DATs. I mean, we have over 20 formats in our AV collection, so it's a lot of different types of materials. And then the third main thing that we're doing for our collection is we're creating a sustainable central repository of digital assets. So in order to do that, we are implementing a new digital asset management system. We need a system where all these new digital files and also our born digital assets are going to live and be preserved for the future. So that's kind of a summary of our project.
Great. Yeah, I'd say our goals are strikingly similar, maybe not so surprising since we're both performing arts related organizations. But the New York Philharmonic is the oldest symphony orchestra in the United States and actually the third oldest in the world. We were founded in 1842, and our first concert was on December 7th of that year. And the institution itself has such a long heritage of not just performing, but of documenting everything. Part of the reason for that is that the original New York Philharmonic members formed the organization as a cooperative institution. And it's important to understand that context around the birth of the organization to understand why we have so much material that spans from that very first concert until today. And even if you go to a Philharmonic concert today and you look at the playbill and the program, it has the number of the concert that you're attending. And the reason we number those concerts is because on the very first program it said first season, first concert. We also have the annual report from very first season. We know who the ticket buyers were for that first season. We know all the institutional assets for that first season. And so all this documentary heritage has really continued to this day and forms really a unique collection, one that there really is no other type of performing arts collection like it. Of course, everyone thinks their collection is special, but I have to give that why we're special. So the digitization project began in 2009. It was funded by the Leon Levy Foundation. The initial phase of the project was to digitize all the paper-based materials between 1943 and 1970, which frames the Leonard Bernstein era of the organization. We've recently received a new grant from the Leon Levy Foundation to continue digitizing the remainder of the paper-based collections from 1842 to 1943. So far, we've put up 1.3 million pages, including printed programs. So every physical printed program that you would receive when you attend a concert. About 17,000 photographs are online from that time period. We also have printed music, so all the marked music scores from Leonard Bernstein, his collection, and also the Andre Castellanets collection, and some other scores that were marked by Mahler, Toscanini, Bruno Walter, and others, as well as orchestral music parts that are marked by Philharmonic musicians. And finally, the business records, which comprise the majority of what we have online, and that's what you would normally think of as archival folders, correspondence, memos, contracts, annual reports, all of the documents that are produced in the daily functioning of the organization. We also do have a lot of audio, of course. We have about 7,000 hours of audio in our archival collection, and all of these things are growing every day. And I think it's an important point to mention that both Carnegie Hall and the Philharmonic are institutional archives and not necessarily taking outside collections as like a special collections at a university or other kind of repository. And that's an important distinction to make because that means that we are also records managers for the institutions. We not only are taking care of the documentary heritage of the past, but we are also trying to formulate a solution to incorporate the past with the present and into the future. And so, like Carnegie Hall, we're part of the motivation for this digitization project was to create a system where we can accession born digital materials as well, and create one unified repository where all the institution's information and digital assets, as well as the paper-based assets, can be available to anyone who desires it inside. And of course, the other main tenant, probably the primary tenant of the digitization itself, is about access. And we principally made the site for scholars. Our philosophy is to put up all of the material that is open to researchers who come into the archives. So we want to replicate the reading room experience as best we can so that you can see more and do more with our collection by viewing it online than even if you had that item in front of you on the reading room table.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as I think just an interesting sidelight here, you know, that is one of the really unique things about the Philharmonic Collection is it goes back the entire history of the organization. Whereas Carnegie Hall, you said it started in 1986. That was right. The beginning of the archives.
And, that's right. Yeah, there was no systematic collecting until then. And it was only when the hall wanted to celebrate its 100th anniversary that the hall decided to try to start to, try to find its history, sort of, which was all over the place. Our director, Gino Francesconi, he advertised in Modern Maturity magazine to try to get all the programs in since Carnegie Hall hadn't been collecting every single program. So that's been really, Gino, our director, has been collecting since then. And he still, you know, is always on eBay and looking out for parts of our history that other people might have that the archives doesn't contain. So, mm-hmm. And one thing I think, I guess about access, there's an interesting story that my boss Kathleen told me, and she recalled an experience a couple years ago where a researcher had come in and wanted to view some Robert Shaw Choral Workshop's videotapes. And we have those materials, we have the original footage, and we also had some access copies. Well, you know, prior to digitization, the access copy was 3/4-inch U-matic videotape. And as most people know, that's kind of like an older, kind of pretty obsolete format. So the researcher had come in and was viewing the 3/4-inch tape in a deck that we did still have, and the tape broke right in the middle of when the researcher was, the deck actually stopped and the tape broke while the researcher was watching it. So that was kind of a wake-up call, I think, for our director. And she sort of realized that, you know, there has to be a better way of trying to of letting researchers access this information that we have. So I think the plan for us is to have a web portal. And right now we're in the early stages of web development. And we will be offering a select, not all of our digital assets, unfortunately, just because due to copyright issues and things like that, but our select digital assets will be available to the public and to researchers on our website. So we're working on a plan for that right now. That's part of our web digital asset management system project. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Ignore the noise from the heating system.
Yeah.
Why the heating system's on and yes, almost May? Heating. I'm not sure, but.
Yes, that's the heating system, not somebody who's tied up against the wall and is clinking their chains. Sure.
They're demanding access, banging on the doors.
So. That's an interesting point, though, that you just mentioned about the copyright issue. And mm-hmm. I've worked with several performing arts organizations on their collections, and that's, you know, often something that comes up, or issues with agreements with the unions about what you can actually
right.
you know, release publicly.
Right,
lots of places have tried to find workarounds for that. Mm-hmm. The Theater on Film and Tape Archive at NYPL mm-hmm. is a good example of that. You know, got contracts set with all the different unions so they could actually record theater productions and present them on site to people who want to come in and research them. So what's been the kind of issues that you've faced with those things?
Yeah, and I think all of our programs we can safely put online, so we'll be doing that. But it's really the audiovisual materials. There are a lot of underlying rights. We've got stagehand rights. At Carnegie Hall, you know, we'll have to look into that issue before we put our audio and video materials online. For some of our documentary projects, you know, there's music and other things that we may have licensed for the actual footage or for the final documentaries. So, you know, these are things that we definitely before we put things online, you know, we need to clear with people or, you know, I mean, I think these days with these kinds of digital archives projects, I think, you know, I think it's good to do your due diligence and to try to clear all the rights if possible. But if not, you know, we might have to look into just having like a clear takedown policy on our website and just doing our best, which, because I mean, if we were literally had to clear all the rights for all of the audio and video, that could take us years, you know. But so it's really a risk management issue. I mean, we have to decide what we can put up and what we can't. But we'd like to be able to, as Mitch said, you know, kind of replicate the replicate like on virtually, you know, a researcher visiting the archives, what would they be able to view on site, you know, that online. So it's going to require a lot of work though. So
yeah, we've already put our collections online, so I can speak a little bit about what we went through and how we approached rights management. All of the material, all the content that we're putting online is primarily, it belongs to the Philharmonic or its work for hire, especially in the paper-based material. It's true that we do get into other kinds of issues when we deal with audio and video, which we would like to resolve at some point so we can start to put all that historic content online. But it's doable. It is definitely doable, working with the parties who hold the rights to these things. So the programs, we really didn't have a problem. They're ours. The business records, all of that material we consider work for hire, since it's all generated as part of the business of the institution. The photos, we did do an analysis of who the photographers were on some of these, or on all of our photo collection, and we made sure to indicate who the photographers were. Again, a lot of these photos are taken, by people who are contracted by the Philharmonic. So we know based on the photographer and when and where what we're freely able to put online. The part that turned out to be the most tricky was the printed music collections. Obviously, music publishers, when IMSLP went online about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, there were, of course, a lot of protests from the publishing industry, and it really disrupted the status quo of how printed music was being accessed. We did not put our printed music in our collection online to simply, allow it to be downloaded and used in performances. And I think that's the distinction that we make. All of the printed music collection that we put online, our music scores and orchestral parts, are marked. And so the added value is based on the addition of the interpreter's markings. When we began the project and we knew we would have a set of printed music that is in copyright that we were going to put up, we did contact all the publishers and we notified them that this is we were putting this up under fair use. We are not allowing downloading. We're not allowing printing. We are going to use every kind of technology available to prevent abuse as best we can. And this is a site that's there for research. And I think because of that difference in intent, that allowed us to be able to do that successfully. We also did have advice from an intellectual property lawyer at Columbia University who helped guide us through that. But we did put
Kenneth
up all...
Kenneth Cruz, perhaps?
What's that?
Kenneth Cruz, perhaps?
No.
What? Strike this from the podcast.
What was I saying? Yeah, but so we were able to put up our printed music items successfully and really haven't had any protest since then. We also did make clear copyright statement. When you open up every score or music part in the collection, it clearly states the purpose, why we're putting this up, and what you can and can't do with all the items. We also listed the publishers in our about page. And honestly, I have been getting a lot of requests from people who want to use the printed music in performance. And a lot of that has generated direction towards the publishers. So we hope that we can work with publishers to continue to make this valuable collection available, and find ways that we can partner with them, because there is an opportunity for us to help them generate more interest and more revenue for these collection items in our collection. But what is amazing about what we have online is it's so easy to look through the material and to see how Philharmonic musicians and the greatest interpreters in the world in the 20th century have prepared and conducted these works.
What's an interpreter exactly? What do you mean when you say that? For the audience?
Yeah, well,
and for me?
Primarily what I mean by that is like the conductor.
The conductor, right.
Yeah. There are so many ways every time a piece is performed, of course, it's not a static entity. It's a living art form that changes as you go and changes from one performance to another. And that's based on, sometimes how much sleep the conductor got the night before. But hopefully it's based on very diligent study. A lot of that study is recorded in the scores. And different conductors have different ways of indicating what they want to do with these pieces. And it is such a valuable asset for not just musicians who are practicing out there, but also musicologists who want to measure and analyze how conductors did their work. Also to look at other types of material that's written into these items. You know, Leonard Bernstein has so many scores where he would scribble in the margins and he would write poetry and he would describe how he felt about these pieces. It was like he had them everywhere. And if he got a moment on the train or the airplane or before he went to sleep, he would write his thoughts. And so there's more than just music in this collection. It really is documentation of at some level the psychology of the people who involve themselves with these items. So
yeah,
but that goes beyond the copyright statement, but it's a little bit extra for you.
So I guess I have a question. So when you talk about the access piece, it'd be interesting to hear from both of you in building online portals and doing sort of big scale digitization, like replicating the reading room experience online, like, you know, that's never going to match for numerous reasons. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe one good one to talk about is like description, discoverability, navigation, you know, obviously things created for analog materials, AKA finding aids, are, you know, they don't necessarily enhance discovery of individual items in a way that can be facilitated in an online discovery environment.
Yeah. And that's kind of a shame.
Yeah.
but it is the way it is.
Right. So, you know, but it's interesting to see archivists, I guess, or the community writ large try to sort of grapple with this transition in, you know, methods of describing and metadata and just thinking about what, you know, the organic shape of a collection is very different if you're literally digitizing everything as it comes in.
Mm-hmm. Well, we should just get a bot that does the reference interview and put that up online.
This is the reference interview podcast. So I'd be interested to hear sort of some of those challenges and details and when it worked and didn't and that sort of thing.
One thing that we realized was, while we do have some finding aids for some of our paper collections, really this project, since we are digitizing everything and putting all the materials into a digital asset management system, we realize that, you know, the finding aid itself is really not we're going to have more detail and description, basically, in the digital asset management system than the finding aid will ever have. Because essentially, we're going to have item-level description for everything. So I think early on, we sort of realized that although for processing the materials prior to digitization, we were able to, it did spur us to actually work on some archivist toolkit finding aids for our collections. I think we're going to have a lot more detail with the online portal of our digital asset management system. So it's kind of been interesting for us, not only for our AV materials, obviously, we have item level description on those, but for some of the paper collections. So,
At the Philharmonic, we, by the time we had started digitization, had these very well, and still have, very well curated databases that contain all the metadata that drive the digital archives. Our performance history is in an institutional database that we continue to add concerts into every night, every time a new concert happens. And likewise for all of our other collections. So we had this foundation of metadata that stretches back, again, this sort of same thread as having this tradition of how we collect. But it stretched back to the 80s, early 80s, when we started to put all this information into databases. And we didn't want to dilute that. We didn't want to change that. We wanted to find a way to incorporate our existing metadata models into this system so that other people would be able to utilize all this work that we had already done. We started at that stage where we said, okay, we have metadata for all of these items. Our business records are done at the folder level, just as you would look up a folder and then have a folder put on the reading room table and then turn through the folder. We don't describe every page in those folders, but we do item level description on other types of items, like our programs obviously are per performance, and the printed music items, a score is an item, and parts are, each one is an item. In terms of access, the biggest challenge that we had is, okay, we're going to digitize 1.3 million pages, and we're going to put all this stuff online on a website. So what does that mean for people who go to it? How do they begin to navigate through through this collection? How do they utilize this metadata? And that's been primarily a user interface challenge to say, okay, where do our controlled vocabularies live on this site so that people can use it to guide themselves through the collection? So we started to put in faceted search. Everything's driven by Solr on the front end. And we also tried to find a way to connect materials in different doc types. So you can jump from a performance to a score that relates to a piece on that performance. And you can jump to photos that relate to the date of that performance and business records that deal with the same subject that matches the performance. So everything in our world is really based on the event. It's based on the performance, and all the other material kind of branches out from there and provides context and additional material. And that's really the way that our metadata works inside the institution. We never got into EAD finding aids or MARC-based metadata description. And that's, again, because of the way we had been doing things in the past. We also think that the issue of interoperability, which is really what metadata standards are about, can now be done on more of a front-end application. Whereas, we don't need to have all of our internal methods conform to those standards in order to make that metadata shareable later on.
Right.
And so we're now working on applying that principle, so we can get our solar, get a new API onto our solar search, and then have that metadata harvestable by other repositories.
And as I remember, don't you have your own metadata schema?
We do. We never really called it a metadata schema.
Yes, it has a name though, doesn't it? What do you call it?
The New York Philharmonic metadata schema.
Okay.
Yeah, and one interesting point is that a lot of industries have created their own metadata schema around what their subject matter is, but we haven't seen that type of conformity amongst performing arts institutions. There are people who are beginning to work on that. I know Doug Reeside at the New York Public Library for Performing Arts has talked about that before, about creating a metadata model for a performance. Mm-hmm. But we're still just starting to have that conversation. And part of the reason is that we all keep our records so differently. Of course, that is the challenge of any collaborative effort. How do you make all of that match up? And then how do you enforce standardization around that? So we just keep going down our own path. And hopefully the fact that we've put all of this material online and exposed all this metadata has driven other institutions, other performing arts institutions, to look at how we've described concerts and how we've described our materials to influence them and how they create metadata around performances.
Is there a lot of collaboration among the performing arts organizations here? I mean, I know there are so many of them, and mm-hmm. and I've worked with Juilliard before. I know that they've been, for several years, have been working on, getting their lists of names and instruments and, everything that they can get together to do description of their student recordings and events that happen there. So. Is there any kind of communication or sharing there?
Not a whole lot.
Not yet, but it's a great idea.
Yeah, yeah, and I think part of the challenge is that in music especially, and the arts in general, but in music there are so many different styles that an institution might be committed to one way or another for marketing purposes, for... internationalization. We have such an international collection with names, titles of works, all in different languages. And we had to decide in the Philharmonic how we're going to catalog these things. And if other institutions, have their own ideas about how they want to spell things on their website, then it's really not going to work. And yes, you can work on creating some level of conformity, but you will always have that pressure when it comes time to do the marketing for your institution, that they're going to have their own way that they want to do things. And they're not going to really want to hear that, some other institution spells it this way, so we should spell it that way. And, so there are a lot of tension. There's a lot of tension there. And that's because we're all living organizations, that are active and doing our own thing. And we're all trying to differentiate ourselves in a world where we need to have the arts be special and present in people's minds. So,
yeah. And that's, you made a really great point, I think, about having the data there just as like some harvestable set, because I know at Carnegie Hall, it's like with the ticketing office, mm-hmm. they're using the same, they're creating some of that data about the performances that are ongoing. They have a record of past ones, that's shareable data that can happen. Right. And so it's like, why should each department be creating that when there can mm-hmm. just be that single source for it?
Yeah, I think we realized during this project, as we started talking about a central repository for our Born Digital and legacy assets, we realized that there were a lot of systems being used at Carnegie Hall, different systems. You mentioned the ticketing system. That's one. We have a historical event database that Archives uses called OPAS. That is one. And also the web content management system. That's another system. So we realized early on that we really needed to work on kind of create coming up with an institutional taxonomy so that all of the internal departments are using the same language. So that's something that we've worked on recently, and we custom developed our taxonomy. It's still kind of in progress right now, but we did submit our first version of the taxonomy to our digital asset management system vendor, and they're going to be incorporating that into the system. So, you know, even with, I mean, I know your question was about external, other organizations kind of working together, but even within Carnegie Hall, there was, you know, we had to kind of create something that was consistent, that would be consistently used within the organization. So I think that's going to help us as, you know, as an institution, kind of as we gather materials from all these different sources and systems, kind of try to speak the same language when it comes to cataloging our materials and presenting them online.
And this is why archives are so important and archivists are so important. Yes. Because they can do that work for the entire organization.
Right. Yeah, we had a similar, or we still do have a similar issue where we have our ticketing system that lives separately from the digital archive system, which lives separately, but it is at least synced with our large internal database that serves, you know, that contains our performance history and all that other information related to it that's used as kind of the brain system of the Philharmonic. But what our goal is with the digital asset management system in building the digital archives is to unify all the information and how we describe everything across the institution. And that's why we chose an open source platform that has a standard API that would, you know, anything can talk to it. We use Alfresco for that. The real benefit is that when other systems have trouble, being communicated with, at least we can always get Alfresco to communicate to anything else. So that's a real benefit of the system that we chose, and in consolidating all of the institutional assets, at least our documentary assets, into this repository, including the Born Digital, we will slowly be rolling out this idea that everything should be described similarly before we get too far down that road of having completely segmented all of our descriptive standards.
Yeah, it sort of speaks to the records management role that you said both of your institutions are playing, and that's, you know, sort of a different responsibility and a somewhat different approach than like the historical legacy, you know, nice, fancy, pantsy material that everybody loves. So how do those two roles play together within your organizations? Like responsibility for retention policies and, you know, getting rid of stuff and dealing with active records as opposed to, you know, historical content.
Yeah, well, we see the active records as just more material in that continuum. Generally, we err on the side of saving more. We do, of course, as the archivists, perform appraisal on records that come from our offices into the archives. But we do have a standard policy and instructions for how departments are to package up material and send it over and when. The challenge is making that happen in the digital environment, because now we're not talking about putting something in a box and putting a list on it and sending it over. Now we're talking about a living, breathing system that is continuously being added to, and more material just accumulates over time. So that is the big challenge that sort of keeps me up at night. You know, how can we, you know, should we make the digital environment conform to the process that we're used to doing in the physical world, or do we just change the way we think about accessioning records? And maybe it's a little bit of both, but what we're trying to do with Alfresco, and the reason we chose that platform, is that it is extensible enough to be able to capture all these different types of records. So it is neutral to whatever you put in it and how you describe those things. So we hope we can, you know, just extend this continuum so that 50-100 years from now, because we know we'll be here 100 years from now.
Well, zombie apocalypse. Yeah. We don't know that.
Even if there's a zombie apocalypse, I'm positive that there will be zombies going to the New York Philharmonic. Sorry, I just lost.
I know. I'm sorry. I keep making jokes, and it throws everybody
the humor.
Off.
I can't handle the level of humor. but really,
but talking
what was
about
I saying?
The records management within the continuum.
So we know that we will be here 100 years from now. So how can we ensure that the researchers 100 years from now can view the material that we're creating today the way we can view the material 100 years ago? And we always are asking this question. Both of ourselves and of all of the vendors we work with who, you know, dam vendors don't necessarily think along those lines. And we have to say we're building a system that is going to outlast all of our lives, you know, and we have to make good decisions about how we are accessioning material and describing things so that we don't create problems for the future. Yep.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned vendors, and this is, I guess, going kind of back about actually doing the digitization project and managing that. I know Carnegie Hall is outsourcing. You're doing some in-house stuff, is that right?
All of our digitization has been done in-house. We do use a vendor to actually set up and perform the photography. And his name is Ardon Barhama. He's an Israeli photographer who's quite extraordinary. So he set up the camera station inside the archive space, and we had three camera stations running at a time, and each camera could produce 2,000 images a day. So we're talking 6,000 pages a day of material just churning through. And of course, surrounding that photography process is everything that comes before and everything that comes after. Beforehand, there's a process of preparation to physically get the material off the shelves, turn through it, flag anything that the photographers need to know while they begin shooting, describe it properly so all the IDs match the physical items and match the, you know, what we have in our database. So all of that has to be done so that the physical item can be sent to the photographers as a package that they know what to do with and can just really do nothing else but shoot one page at a time and get through the material as fast as they can. And then they do some post-processing after they're finished shooting, and after that the images get ingested with the metadata into our asset management system. And then we proof every page. So the quality control on our project is quite extraordinary. We do compare every page.
6,000 a day.
6,000 a day.
Who has that thankless job?
a team of...
highly skilled.
Yes. We like to call it the history sweatshop. We had a team of really great interns and students and volunteers who were processing all this material, doing the prepping and the proofing. And my role in all of this was really to be the octopus to, measure how much work was piling up in every part of this process so that we could eventually get every item approved. The biggest challenge we had in our workflow was really what happens when there's something wrong. When you proof the item and you see that a page is missing, now you have to have a whole other sub-process for dealing with returning that item to the photographer, making sure it's not lost in the process or lost generally,
right.
Making sure that they know exactly what's wrong so that they can correct it appropriately, and then getting it back into the system and then getting it proofed again. And so this loop just would keep happening on every single item until it was all approved. And then there is a stage of metadata correction and refinement that had to happen before we would finally launch the material online. So that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah. So what parts, I guess, were automated or do you think could be automated in the future or near future?
Well, we have now that we have a chance to embark on a new phase of the project, we did a lot of introspection and looking at our process and how we could change it and improve it. We are going to utilize Lightroom, Adobe Lightroom, a lot more in both the prepping and the proofing and the photography side, instead of only letting the photographers use that kind of software. And the reason for that is we can use that software to communicate. So if we write notes in the same system on a piece of material, if something gets flagged that we need the photographers to know, then they can see that in, if they're using the same system.
Yeah.
So there's been a little bit of that, like instead of taking, instead of getting different types of software to work on different parts of the process, we're trying to unify the types of software packages that are used for everybody. I will say that automated workflows generally, at least for us, have not been satisfactory. And the reason is just that you need a developer to implement them, and then you need a developer if you want anything changed. And we really needed to have more flexibility than that. We started out doing automated workflows to control this whole process, the whole approval process. And it just didn't work, because when we wanted to capture a new piece of data when someone was, say, proofing the material, we had no way of doing that, of implementing that. So we really captured everything in Google Docs and just shared spreadsheets. And that got us through pretty well the whole first phase. Now we're hoping to have something a little bit more structured than that in our process, but we're still shaping that before we start digitizing.
Can I ask what the decision was to do it in-house as opposed to going out to a vendor? And what was your the push there for that, or what the reasoning?
Well, we just the fact that it would have been a huge logistical nightmare to, you know, digitizing 1.3 million pages, we're talking about, you know, hundreds of boxes. And the logistics of shipping all of that offsite, then receiving it, then proofing it, and then what if something's wrong? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you correct that stuff? The other benefit to having everything done on site is that we have direct communication with the photographers themselves. You know, we have the ability to recognize trends if there's something that's kind of going awry and say, hey, photographers, you know, there's a problem here. Let's talk about this. Yeah, and
take
fix
the lens
it.
Cap off.
Yeah, yeah. For instance. Luckily, that didn't happen. But yeah, you know, we were able to have that interaction daily with the people who were doing the imaging. And you need, at least in our case, because we were doing such a huge volume of material, we had to have that interaction. And there was also, thirdly, this principle that the items needed to be proofed very soon after they were photographed. And that's because people are using our collection all the time. And we didn't want to have anything in limbo for too long. We wanted to have the process move as fast as we could, so the time it was off the shelf or out of the folder or whatever it was minimal. And that's just because the less time you have something sitting outside of its box, the less chance there is that you're going to lose it or damage it.
Yep.
So all those things contributed to that decision.
So I guess for Carnegie Hall, early on, we realized that we didn't have the office space or the staff or the equipment to do this large reformatting and digitization project in our grant period. So we're outsourcing all the digitization. However, we do have a flatbed scanner, And we digitize some things in-house ad hoc, and we plan to digitize small collections in-house in the near future. And one of the main reasons also that we outsource the digitization was that we're getting conservation work done on our paper materials prior to digitization. So all of our programs and architectural drawings and flyers, they're getting sent out to Northeast Document Conservation Center to be conserved first. They're performing conservation on the older programs and drawings that are suffering from embrittlement and discoloration due to the acidic nature of the paper. And the conservators are putting the programs in filtered water, reducing acidity, residue, and alkalizing the papers. So then the bound volumes, they're going to be unbound, conserved, and digitized. For our audio and video items, the vendors are doing inspection and cleaning on the materials, and for some formats such as quarter-inch reel-to-reel, Carnegie Hall's rehousing the items from their original cardboard boxes into archival-quality polypropylene cases. The film collections are not only being inspected, repaired, and digitized, the film vendors also performing some film-to-film preservation on them and delivering new 16-millimeter color answer prints with sound, color digital intermediates, optical soundtracks, and preservation magnetic soundtracks. So, you know, these things we obviously couldn't do in-house. And all of our film materials are being rehoused into archival quality cans, and some of our materials are eventually going to be stored off-site in cold storage. We have a partnership with the Academy Film Archive for some of our films, so they'll be located there. You mentioned the logistical difficulties of outsourcing, and that's definitely an issue in terms of shipping materials. That's something that can be challenging when you're shipping a huge amount of materials. Thankfully, we work with a vendor that provides us with shipping bins and can coordinate the pickup of, you know, large pallets of our materials. And shipping off some of our fragile materials took some careful consideration because we do have like our lacquer instantaneous discs. We didn't want to just FedEx them or UPS them. They're you know, we don't want them to break. So we thought about, for example, like driving them to our digitization vendor ourselves, which, you know, would be fine, but they're like 8 hours away. So instead, you know, we talked to some people and we ended up using an art handling shuttle service to carefully, well, we pack them ourselves carefully and then they ship them along with like other fragile art to that area. So, you know, I think logistically it's been kind of, that has been kind of challenging, but we do everything in batches, so it's pretty manageable. Mm-hmm. I think that's it for that question.
We'll have to think of another one. Well, it'd be interesting to hear, I guess, maybe even just more informal conversational comments about the project management stuff. I mean, Mitch, I know you like present and do workshops on this a lot. And, you know, I think a lot of archives that are trying to digitize more and more and more haven't necessarily encountered some of the like stuff that you both have in large scale projects. Mm-hmm. You know, project management, thinking about managing, you know, diverse teams. I think you were talking photographers and interns and archivists.
Yeah.
And is this something you learned in school?
No. For me, not at all. There are a couple different ways to approach that question, I guess. First, there's the, you know, a lot of people come to us wanting to know how they can sort of do what we did, you know, how they can digitize their collections in a manner that seemed to work so well for us and has, not to boast, but created this beautiful online presentation. It's so easy to use. The first question that you really have to answer is, what is the universe of material that you want to digitize and why? And I think that you know, a lot of people don't really consider that until they actually hear someone else ask them the question. And the reason you need to have that answer that is both because it helps formulate your own project, but also it helps for you to be able to describe that to other people, especially funders. You know, we were very fortunate to have the Leon Levy Foundation as a great funder, not just because they gave us all the money to do what we wanted to do, but also because they were and are very good at asking us questions, to check us on you know, what we're thinking about and what our motivation is and how this is going to serve users and et cetera, et cetera. And it's important to at least set that groundwork before you really embark on a project of this size. And another thing that occurred before I even came on board was to gain an understanding of that universe, the archivist, Barbara Hawes, the archivist historian, she actually counted pages. She counted pages in folders and counted pages in scores and came up with an idea of how many pages we're looking at. And by and large, it ended up being pretty accurate. But that allowed us to go to funders and say, we want to digitize 1.3 million pages. Here's how much we expect it to cost per page. And so here's the amount of money that we need. And having that in your mind, it really defines or helps you define all the other areas of the project. In terms of managing teams, I would stress training as the biggest challenge, you know, just to maintain consistency throughout a very assembly line type of process. We designed the workflow as a kind of assembly line intentionally so that each group of people could maximize their efficiency on a particular task. And it worked pretty well, you know, but the challenge as a project manager was keeping on top of what all these people are doing when they are doing all these different types of tasks. And the way you keep track of that is by raising red flags, you know, finding methods for people to raise red flags to you. And to encourage people to ask questions. You know, archival digitization is not like digitizing modern paperwork in, you know, an insurance company environment or something like that. These are materials that are not only fragile, they also vary in size, in color, in media, in shape, you know, whatever. And we need to prepare people to deal with all these different types of situations. And maybe, or I'd say a lot of the way that we've prepared them is simply by presenting them with all the different ways to solve problems and encouraging people to ask those questions. When we hire someone new to come in and work on any part of this process, I do train these people individually, and I try in the beginning to make sure that they understand how their part of the work fits into the entire process. And that's really important because a lot of this work can be pretty monotonous. It can be pretty, it can be difficult to just turn pages for 7.5 hours and look at, you know, stuff and process. And it has to be done really fast. It has to be done efficiently. So part of the way to handle that is by, you know, is just instilling a kind of motivation that you're a part of something that's really significant and really big, and your role makes a big difference in how this whole thing's going to turn out. Yeah. And even, you know, when we photographed all the material, we photograph, like for our business records, we photograph the folder cover. On which we've written in marker the ID of the folder and some other kind of prepping marks and the initials of the person who did the prepping and who did the proofing. And I bet that some of those people are going to look in 50 years back at this material and say, oh, those are my initials. I worked on that. Isn't that neat?
Those are online too, right?
Yeah, it's online.
Cool.
I definitely feel like my graduate school education, as well as Josh knows, I went to NYU's Moving Image Archiving and Preservation Program, and I feel like that did definitely prepare me at least for handling audiovisual materials and understanding, you know, how to digitize them and working with vendors. We studied those kinds of things in school. Obviously, it was mostly theoretical, not all practical. So, you know, I think I've learned a lot of the practical skills needed for managing this type of digitization project on the job. Project management skills, per se, were not a part of my training, so I feel like, you know, those skills have just kind of accumulated from my past experiences working in documentary production or at other archives, but I'd say that knowing how to use Excel spreadsheets and project management software tools such as Basecamp and being able to create work plans and timelines and knowing how to write well in terms of writing RFPs and statement of works and grant proposals is definitely part of the job. And, you know, those are skills that you don't necessarily learn at school. You just have to learn those through experience. So, but my training was, you know, already it's back like 7-8 years ago. And so I think there have been a lot of changes in the digital landscape just even within that time. And I think keeping up by going to conferences and continuing with professional development is really important to keep up with the latest tools and best practices. So I do wish that maybe they taught like command line in school. That's something, and kind of writing scripts. I feel like that's something I wish I knew how to do. And I'm still learning.
Class coming up at Metro here.
I mean, I'm still learning the basics
for those of us who booked it.
I'm still learning the basics of command line, but I wish that were part of the school training now. And maybe it is now. I don't know. Maybe the programs are changing.
Yeah, it is. It is at NYU in the program now.
Okay. So then
we missed out on it.
Yeah.
But.
I'm dating myself. So. Yeah.
And I guess also you're working with lots of different departments as well because this project is touching on not just the archives materials, but the materials that are being produced by other departments as well.
Yeah, this project is not just an archives department project, although we are the project lead. Early on, we realized that we needed a central digital repository for the entire institution that would support not just the legacy digitized assets, but also the born digital assets. So the Digital Archives Project, it has a core team, which meets to discuss issues and make decisions on some of the major activities for the project. So, and it consists of staff from different departments, such as archives, PR, IT, e-strategy, which is in charge of web content and our website and social media, and the Weill Music Institute, which is the educational arm of Carnegie Hall. And the core team also consists of our outside consultants that help us and guide us for this project. So we're all working collaboratively to make the best decisions for Carnegie Hall. One thing that as I go back to the question that you had about you know, your training and background and all that. One thing that's been really interesting for me is just, I feel like I've learned so much working closely with the IT department, especially since we're working on figuring out like digital storage and policies related to digital asset management within Carnegie Hall. It's really important to kind of work closely with your IT department and to definitely befriend them and ask them a lot of questions. As an archivist, I feel like having some of the IT knowledge and, you know, at least being able to speak some of their language is really important for a successful digital archives project. So,
yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, by befriending the IT department in your institution, you gain a lot of knowledge, but you also gain, you know, cooperation. Oftentimes, at least in every institution I've worked for, I always make friends with the IT department first of all the other departments in the institution, because it's always great to, first of all, know how the infrastructure is laid out in your institution, if you're going to be adding a lot of infrastructural needs to the institution by implementing a digital asset management system or even just installing lots of software or having new workstations installed, you really need not just their expertise, but their help to pull off all these things, and also access privileges to be able to install software, test software as you need. And you know, it's just essential to have that really a great collegial relationship with the IT folks. And I think a lot of times as digital project managers who are often embedded in archives departments, we tend to be the people who translate between the IT department and also IT vendors, and then the archive staff who, you know, can have different levels of understanding of various technology concepts. So learning as much as we can about technology and trends, and even if it's languages or practices or version control or all of these things, these are all things that we need to learn how to communicate both with the technology side and the non-technology side.
Yeah.
So, and we need to be concerned both with content and then how the technology can aid the development of content and the accessibility of content. So,
yeah, we didn't talk too much about Born Digital, but we are running out of time, so maybe we shouldn't. so yeah, no, we're well over an hour at this point. Right, yeah, we could talk another hour about Born Digital.
I don't think we want to open up that can of worms.
So maybe just some brief summary statements, or do you have any sort of...
like lessons learned?
Lessons learned here
or
that you can...
just something you want to tout about the great work that you both have done.
Well, I can talk a little bit about outreach, because I think that's a really important component of what we do. You know, we're creating these sites that have tremendous value and tremendous quantity of material. So how do we get people to use it? And we found it to be very effective to just go to conferences and talk to people about it. What we've started doing is actually advertising the Digital Archives as a product to actually exhibit it in exhibit halls at conferences. And we find people coming up to us for all kinds of reasons. You know, maybe they went to a young people's concert some years ago and feel this relationship with the Philharmonic and are just wondering why we're there. And then other people have heard of the project and want, you know, a walkthrough of what we have online. But we've been to historian conferences, music library conferences, digital preservation conferences, and even education conferences. There's a conference every year for the K through 12 public school librarians of New York City. And we heard about this when we were at a different conference, and we were so glad we went because, you know, every audience brings their different types of interests and their different types of needs, but also different types of suggestions on how to improve the product. The most important thing for us is to put the material online. The site was designed for scholars, but now that it's online, we can continue to refine how people use it and build new portals on top of that content. And that is all shaped by the users, by the people who who are the targets of our outreach efforts. So that's such an important and critical part of these projects, because we don't want to spend all this time and money to put things online and then not know anything about what happens with it.
Yeah, good point.
So, certainly. I want to talk about one thing. Just mention that we're part of this pilot project with Northeast Document Conservation Center, and they recently were awarded an IMLS grant to test out IRENE. And I think some of you might be familiar with it, but IRENE stands for Image, Reconstruct, Erase Noise, etc. And it's a new reformatting technology that uses digital imaging to safely retrieve the audio from historical recordings made on discs and cylinders without endangering the original carrier. So we're working on them with that, and that's going to be interesting for us because we submitted some lacquer discs for the project to them that we already digitized through the traditional way through our other audiovisual vendor. So I think it might end up being an interesting side-by-side comparison eventually of just the two different ways of reformatting audio. So, and then some of the lessons learned that I want to talk about. Just for a project of this size, I would say definitely don't be afraid to ask questions and talk to your peers about what they are doing and how they are handling these types of big projects. I know as archivists, sometimes you're like the lone person at your institution running a project or, taking care of the archives. So it's really nice to talk to your peers and just to learn from each other. Also, with something where, you're working on a project that's on a specific timeline, I would say to be flexible with your timeline. things don't always happen as in the way that you estimate a year or two in advance. So I feel like things always take longer than you expect, actually.
I agree with that. Yes. Having never met a deadline in my life.
Yeah. And I guess we talked a little bit about the quality control, quality assurance aspect of, when you are checking your digital files. And I've been really lucky to use some time-saving tools that have really streamlined our quality control process. So, some scripts that make batch checking embedded metadata go fast, scripts that make batch checking, invalidating checksums go quickly. So things like that have really helped us with our project. So, and I definitely just would echo a lot of what Mitch said about advocating for your dams projects. We've just started to go on the road and kind of talk about our digital archives project at conferences. Last year I was at EMEA. This year I'm going to be at the CIBMUS TLA conference. And my colleague Rob Hudson is going to be talking about our performance history search, which is now online at a New York State Archives conference. So, things like that, we really need to you really need to kind of spread the word of the work that you're doing so that other archivists can also learn from your project as well.
Yes. Also the intent of our podcast.
Yes. Yes.
And thank you guys for doing all this work to...
Well, we wouldn't have a podcast if we didn't have guests. So thanks to you.
Thank you guys.
Okay. Yeah. Hi. Guess that's it.
It's a good note. We look like the good guys in the end, so we should stop now.
No, we're just here to have good people talk to us. So.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.